I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. On this fresh edition of The Book Show, we'll talk with you about what's on the bestsellers list, what's out right now, what's just coming out. We'll talk about books we've enjoyed, and I'll read some contributions from the book Drivel. Drivel celebrates deliciously bad writing by some well-known writers who decided to cough up material that they had shoved away in drawers, or boxes in the attic. I'm talking about their diaries, early columns. And these are writers like Amy Tan, Dave Eggers, Rick Moody, Mary Roach, who wrote a newspaper column on guppies. And my favorite contribution to Drivel, how do you say his name? Chuck Poluniak? I think that's it.
I'd say it that way.
Okay. So let's get started. In the studio with me, Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers, an independent bookstore in Madison, Connecticut. On the phone, we have Amy Bloom, whose most recent novel is Lucky Us, and she teaches writing at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Amy, we'll start with you. What do you recommend? Welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, more or less. Well, the first thing that I did was take a look at Death Comes to Pemberley because I liked the television version so much.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I am like most, you know, sensible women, a big Elizabeth Bennet fan. And I have to say that it's very rare for me to say this, but I actually think the television version was better.
Really?
It's hard for me to say because I think T.D. James is to be revered. There's nothing by her I haven't read and enjoyed, but I think that she is a deeply creative person, and it felt to me that she was a little constrained by the characters who already existed, who did not have, you know, that great dark P.D. James quality, you know.
Do you feel like you wasted your time, though?
No. When I feel like I'm wasting my time with a book, I just stop.
Yeah, me too.
I am not one of those nice, admirable people who says, oh, I only have 154 pages to go. I must persevere. I think, you know, 100 pages in, you sort of know. The only book that I ever changed my mind about was Annie Proulx's The Shipping News. Because 60 pages in, I thought, oh, what have I done to deserve this terrible experience? And 75 pages in, I thought, oh, this is great. I'm so glad I'm reading it.
Amy, I stopped at 60 and never picked it back up on Shipping News.
See, just 15 more pages. That's what we're all hoping for. That's why we go on.
Yeah, I know, but I think it's only happened to me once, and I've been reading for a really long time, so... So there was Death of Pemberley. I have been reading Edward St. Albans' Lost for Words, which is a break from his Patrick Melrose books, which are essentially autobiographical fiction, I think, as he would say, and also about the ways in which it might be possible to survive and even flourish, having had a truly hideous childhood. And it's all with a lot of wry Englishness, and Lost for Words is really his take on literary prizes and literary contests. And, you know, it has a lot of cheerful English, dry snark, which I always appreciate, probably a little too much. Probably one should not get, especially if one is English, that wrought up over the stupidity of contests, because after all, one is free to ignore them.
Yeah,
it is a fun read.
I read a long excerpt of that in The New Yorker and loved it.
Yeah, I mean, he's very smart and very interesting. The other book like that I had really enjoyed, I never get her name right, Jinxie Wills, she wrote a book which was brilliant called National Book Award Winner, I believe, about two sisters and whether or not one of them would win a literary prize. It was very smart and very funny. Plus, I love the fact that the book was, I'm pretty sure, called National Book Award Finalist or National Book Award Winner.
I don't know that book, Amy.
And I think to myself, That's what I should call all of my books.
I know. That's what I'm thinking.
So here's a question. Here's a question for Amy and Faith. What do you think is the benefit or detriment of these book awards?
Well, I always have mixed feelings towards them. It's like, well, you know, they haven't been bad to me, you know, book awards things. On the other hand, as my children first said when they saw my first book of collections that said National Book Award finalist, one of my daughters said to me, "Oh, Mommy, that's so much nicer than loser." So it's like, and I said, "It is much nicer than loser. That's how we are in literary circles." But I think that, on the other hand, having now been on the prize giving side a few times, you know, it's like the sausage making factory. It's not so pretty. And the ways in which decisions get made and the factors that go into it, I'm not saying that they shouldn't go into it, but it's, you know, that when you are on one of those committees giving out an award, you will not be simply saying, "This is the best book." That will not be the only consideration. And, you know, that can be a little disheartening both for the committees and for the writers. You look at the history of Pulitzers and your mouth opens at the number of books you would never dream of reading.
So, yeah. Wow, you know, that's so interesting. What are some of the other considerations?
For me, recently?
No, I mean...
other than the best book.
Oh, well, I think, other than best book, I think one of the considerations is who have we not heard from in a long time, whether it's an individual, maybe there's a writer rising up from a country that has been markedly underrepresented in American writing, you know, immigrant pop though we are. Maybe it is... something very different in the approach to the structure of the novel, and people are feeling like the last four books that have won this prize have been just straightforward novels. We really want to encourage people to do something else. I mean, so that it's often beyond just the book itself. It represents, or it encourages, or it opens the door to, all of which I think are very good things. But they are not all the impulses are not always going in the same direction.
That's so fascinating.
You know, I have a very generous view of prizes. And it's because I think anything that starts talking about a book in a way that is at least thoughtful, even if it's got the ingredients that Amy's talking about, you know, because I don't really know what the best book is, you know, based on what standard, based on it being fresh, provocative, thoughtful, genius.
Arrives in your life at a time that's important.
You know, fun. You know, I don't know. So to me, I know a lot of people like Amy who have been judges who I consider pretty good readers. And so I have a lot of faith that they're picking out a book that might be fun for people to read. And I think people are looking for guidance. So I don't feel, you know, I've never lost one and I've never been a finalist and I've never submitted one. So I'm a bookseller. So to me, I find them helpful. It makes customers pay attention to books. It makes booksellers pay attention to it. It makes publishers think about it. So I have a generous view, but I think some people feel put out by the process.
Yeah.
So, I think you can do both, actually. I just want to say, I mean, I think that anything that makes people pay attention to books, encourages them to read, gives them a reason to think about books, is all to the good. I absolutely am not in the category of, let's just get rid of all the prizes. I just think that they are complex processes. And probably the more you are involved with it, sort of closer, the closer you are to the fan, the more mindful you are of the propellers and not just the breeze.
And when you were saying the book, National Book Award, either winner or finalist, it was Jinxie, we think. And what's the last name?
Wills, W-I-L-L-S. I realize I should be better prepared for this, but her book just came into my head. Mm-hmm. And she's not somebody who has written often. I think she's written three novels. But it was just, you know, so... It was just very, partially the title was so clever, and it was a fun and interesting book about, in some ways, about the nature of competition, which is what made me think of St. Albans Law.
Yeah, now I want to read that. That sounds really good. Amy, thank you so much. I just want to let you know that later on in the show, we're going to feature the book Drivel.
Uh-huh.
Which is deliciously bad writing by your favorite authors. So the contributors include Dave Eggers, Amy Tan, Rick Moody, Mary Roach, Gillian Flynn, and writers we probably don't know about. Do you have more books?
The only other book I have is Teju Cole's novella, Every Day is for the Thief, which is really about whether you can or cannot go home again. And in this case, home happens to be Lagos. But I just think it's just compelling and moving, and there is enough that is sort of both mysterious and ominous, and enough that is so familiar to anybody who has, you know, gone from Ohio to New York and back home to Cleveland at Christmas. It's both very fresh and I think very familiar.
Every day is for the thief. Thank mm-hmm. you, Amy, so
My
much.
My pleasure.
Amy
Bye,
Bloom.
Everybody. Bye, Amy.
Amy Bloom, who is author of her most recent novel, Lucky Us. I'm with Roxanne Cody. And Roxanne, what do you have?
So there's going to be a theme to the books that I'm thinking of. And I'm uninteresting enough to consider the new year motivation to a new you.
Mm, me too.
So one of the books that I have really been struck by is a book called The Art of Stillness. And it is actually a book put together. It's by Pico Ayer, I-Y-E-R. And I'm not sure I'm saying it right. And it was a TED Talk. And Simon & Schuster is putting together some of these TED Talks. So I saw it in the bookstore. And it is about the idea, and it of going nowhere, and it's a version of thinking of being present, is something that is critical to our being creative and our having a sense of peace. And there's a little paragraph in there where an Icelandic photographer that provided these beautiful scenes of sunsets and sunrises and bodies of water talks about looking through the lens and really seeing it. And then at the way he describes it, and I think this is a maybe a good way to explain it. You can go on a vacation to Paris or Hawaii or New Orleans 3 months from now, and you will have a tremendous time, I'm sure. But if you want to come back feeling new, alive, and full of fresh hope and in love with the world, I think the place to visit is nowhere. And the idea to me of being in love with the world by just by being where you are is very powerful to me. Very powerful. And I had written a thought for the new year to our customers, and I talked about I was up in Maine, and I know Faith always equates being up in Maine with, you know, being the peaceful me, but it's the place that's got the big sky that makes you notice nowhere.
Yeah, that the place where you're truly connected with nature.
Yeah. So it's called The Art of Stillness by P-I-C-O, and his last name is I-Y-E-R. I'm in love with this book.
Yeah, and you did such a good job just now of explaining that.
Oh, good.
Really,
thank you.
Wonderful. We're going to take a quick break. We'd like to open the phones so we can give you a chance to tell us about a book that you loved as we go on. 203-776-9677. Easy way to remember, 203-776-WNPR here on the Faith Middleton Show. Books, more books, books all over the place in here. Stay with us for great reads. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. And of course, right now, 24/7, we have all of our, we have the books up there. And also, we have lots and lots of recipes for the start of the new year and wine and cocktails, things to recommend at foodschmooze.org. Roxanne Cody is with me in the studio. We've just talked to Amy Bloom, and we're inviting you to tell us about a book you love, either new or a classic. Anything in between, fiction, nonfiction. We're interested in all kinds of books. 203-776-WNPR. John, welcome to the book show.
Yes, thank you very much, Faith, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yes. I'm a member of a book group, and our book group consists mostly of men, and they tend to like nonfiction. So we've been reading nonfiction books for quite some time, and we are reading a few right now that I thought would be interesting for some of your readers.
Okay, let's hear.
Okay. The first one is Matt Taibbi's book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Taibbi is a terrific writer, very fast-moving little vignettes in this story, basically contrasting the justice at the bottom end of the socioeconomic scale with the justice that's received at the top end. I think it's very fitting in the light of the kind of reports we've been getting in the current news about, you know, the justice system, how it's working for Americans, some Americans, and not working perhaps for a lot of others.
Okay. Matt Taibbi, The Divide. Go ahead.
Right. The second one, which we're also taking on at the present moment, is called The Teacher Wars. Dana Goldstein is the author. It's a history of America's most embattled profession, the teaching profession, obviously. And it's historical in nature. And it really gives you a very interesting glimpse into the past with respect to how teaching was dealt with in the past and how, strangely enough, many of the battles of the past are emerging even now. I mean, it's like revisiting the past. So what was old is now new again, and so forth. So I thought that was interesting. As a corollary to that one, I'm reading on my own, unrelated to book group, the last one that I would mention to your readers, which is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. This is by a woman named Diane Ravitch. Excellent, outstanding, very, very quick reading, very well researched, and really does a hammer job on many of the privatization, charter schools, other types of remedies that are being promoted as a solution to America's public school performance issues and teacher evaluations and so forth. So I just thought that those three might be of some interest to at least one of those might be.
I so appreciate this. So Matt Taibbi did The Divide, and we have The Teacher Wars by Dana Goldstein and Reign of Error by Diane Ravitch.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you so much for the list. I hope you will continue to call.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, John. All right. Yes. Bye-bye. Bye. And on behalf of John, I want to say I looked up the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction just to see what was going on. And so we start out with, in the number one position, Unbroken by Laura Hellenbrand. And this is the story of an Olympic runner, his survival as a prisoner of the Japanese in World War II. I'm quoting from the Times on these little short descriptions. In the number two position, something called American Sniper by Chris Kyle and Scott McEwen and Jim DeFelice. And this is about a former member of the Navy SEALs talking about his battlefield experiences during the Iraq War. Very controversial book. Kyle was shot to death in Texas last year. Number three position. And by the way, that American Sniper was at seven, and so it's moved up to two. I don't know what this bump means at this point, because I'm thinking a lot of this has to do with the holiday choices, and so we'll see next time it comes out, next time we do the book show, what's moving up and what's moving down. So Unbroken, Laura Hillenbrand, American Sniper by Chris Kyle and others. And then in the number three position, this seems to have stuck where it was. We have Wild by Cheryl Strayed. This is, I think everybody knows this. This is a woman's account of this 1,100-mile hike along the Pacific Crest Trail back in 1990. It's a movie now.
And Faith, that's one of the things I think that's important to note. Unbroken and Wild are both movies just out. And there's been this wonderful plethora of books that are being turned into movies. You know, Reese Witherspoon optioned Wild early. Angelina Jolie got involved in Unbroken early, and it's been great for the movie industry, but it's been wonderful for the book industry.
And so intriguing to see these actors in Hollywood deciding themselves.
Exactly.
I mean, Reese Witherspoon and I forget the friend that she works with.
Yeah.
But they direct and they...
And they have a production company.
They pick their own stuff. It's really interesting to see this happen. Killing Patton by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. This is about the what he refers to as the strange death of General George Patton in December 1945. That was at number two and is at four now. Amy Poehler's book, Yes, Please, this book that everybody loves. I'm talking about Amy Poehler from Saturday Night Live. George W. Bush's book called 41 about his father is, you know, still up there. The Boys in the Boat, that just never seems to sink. Daniel James Brown, and it's about, we've talked about it on this show, about the crew and their quest for the gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And we'll do just three more, so we'll keep it to 10. What If by Randall Munroe. These are all, again, nonfiction books. Scientific, but I gather funny, answers to hypothetical questions based in part on the author's
website.
It's
a great book.
Is it good?
It's so much fun.
I don't know this far. I haven't even looked at this. Not That Kind of Girl by Lena Dunham, of course, of the show Girls on HBO. These are her personal essays. And in the number 10 position, Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, the surgeon and New Yorker writer, how doctors fail patients at the end of life and how they can do better. I have heard so much about this book.
It's great.
Recently from people. You know, I think people might have received this over the holidays, and they're just, everywhere I go, people are talking about this book. So I'm interested to see if this is going to start to shoot up even higher than number 10. So those are the nonfiction, including ebooks, that are on the New York Times bestseller list. Roxanne, go ahead.
So this is, again, in the theme of, you know, I happened to be wandering in the bookstore, you know, and picked these up. So this book struck me. It's called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing.
I just read this.
Oh, how funny.
Yep.
So it is based not on the, you know, clean one.
Who's the author? I'm sorry.
Her name is Marie Kondo, K-O-N-D-O. So it's based on the Japanese system called the KonMari method, KonMari. And it's got some interesting ways to go about this. But here's the big takeaway for me. I've never read a book about organizing that used this term. Does the object bring you joy.
Yeah, I think, was it spark joy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here's the way I think about it. So I, for the good and the bad of it, have not changed clothes sizes in many, many years. So I have a lot of clothes that I've bought over the years. Some of them, you know, were bad purchases, but I refuse to get rid of them. And worse, I put them on and I wear them, and then they put me in a bad mood all day because I think I look fat, I look old, I look ugly, whatever's the problem with the outfit. You know, it's out of style. I look so yesterday, you know, whatever ridiculous thing.
I'm running into my own shoulders.
Yeah. whatever silly, horrible thing. My legs look short, my head look, whatever. So, and I think, what really? Mm-hmm. I am now looking at everything with this filter.
Does it spark joy? And it's not just clothes with her. Of course, it's everything
objects,
around you.
Yeah.
Of any kind. So can I just also add about this book?
That I can't believe you read it too. That's so funny.
Well Amy suggested it to me. And I, you know, so I've read it. I've been reading it in sections. And in the beginning, I thought it was, for me, quite interesting. And I agree. I thought, oh, spark joy, that's interesting. I too, have never read an organizer who's talked quite this way. But as I went through the book and got more into it, I began to become a little, you know, I get this kind of weird feeling because she talks about that part.
Well, she's a little maniacal.
Well, yeah, she talks about this part of going into people's, her family members'
yeah.
rooms and just changing everything without asking permission. And then it started to get a little on the bossy side or a little controlling.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. But you know what? I like bossy girls. I think bossy girls are good. And I took away from it what I didn't particularly like her, to your point. You know, as I got further into it, I thought, I don't really like her. I didn't warm to her, but I thought she had a very cool way of us thinking about what we surround ourselves with, and more importantly, the impact on us of that. You know, I sometimes think of it as just okay, I'm annoyed by that, but really, it's more than that.
It's the same theory, I think, as when you buy a piece of art and or given a piece of art, and there are some art things that stay with you your whole life and remain important to you, and then other pieces that just fade.
They're benign.
It's very hard to understand what that's about, whether it connects with some kind of emotion. She did, I agree, Roxanne, she got me to think about it. This is like a Siskel and Ebert thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
She got me to think about all that. So that's good. So The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up by Marie Kondo, K-O-N-D-O. Mary, welcome to the book show.
Hello. Hi. Thank you. I would like to recommend a book called The Memory Keeper's Daughter. It's a first novel by an author named Kim Edwards. I wonder if any of you have ever heard of her and if she wrote anything more, because this is a marvelous book. It's a novel.
Yes, we know this book. It's The Memory Keeper's Daughter. I'm so glad you talked about it. Roxanne, have you read this?
It was huge. I have not read it. We had a lot of our booksellers, but it was a big bestseller for a very long time when it came out. But, you know, you're asking an interesting question because I don't know if she's written anything else. It's certainly nothing that was as big as Memory Keeper's Daughter.
Right. Thank you, Mary, so much for bringing that up and reminding us.
You're welcome.
Okay. Keep calling as you read more things, okay?
I will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're
Bye-bye.
Welcome. 203-776-9677. I wanted to let you know that one of the things that has come out is Almost Famous Women from Megan Mayhew Bergman. And this explores the life on the fringes of fame through the lives of real women that you know, some people might have heard of and others maybe not. So this is a collection of stories. And in this book, this isn't a kind of romanticizing of these women. This is resurrecting them and looking at the difficult choices that define the lives of these people. So we're talking about cross-dressing Standard Oil heiress Joe Carstairs, who buys an island and rules it. While she's racing
there's
boats,
a bossy girl.
Racing boats and womanizing. The conjoined Hilton twins, who were in this kind of show business sensation. Beryl Markham wasn't just this aviator and author. She was also the first female horse trainer and lived alone in a tent on a racetrack in Nairobi. The International Sweethearts of Rhythm, that was the nation's first integrated all-girl swing band. And they had this excellence that people still talk about. But they ran into these amazing situations when they were touring down south because of the Jim Crow laws. We have Lord Byron's illegitimate daughter, Oscar Wilde's wild niece, Edna St. Vincent Millay's sister. They all star in these stories. So Almost Famous Women from Megan Mayhew Bergman. That is out. John Faith Middleton and Roxanne Cody, welcome to the book show.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm calling about a book named Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman.
Okay, so Misquoting Jesus by...
Bart Ehrman. He's a biblical scholar at the Chapel Hill College in North Carolina.
How do you spell Ehrman?
I think it's either E-R-H-M-A-N or E-H-R-M-A-N.
Okay. And so,
it's an important book because it's the first time a biblical scholar actually took scholarly information about the New Testament and made it available to the public. And for anyone who's looking to learn a little bit more about faith and what's real and what's not, it's an amazing book that's actually really upset the fundamental Christian population because it completely puts a damper on, you know, beliefs like the world is 6,000 years old and people lived with dinosaurs and the stuff that, you know, fundamental Christians believe.
Well, you know, of course, this is such a thing, is such a touchy subject for many, many people who've grown up believing, who have a set of beliefs.
Sure.
And, you know, here it is. And then a religious scholar or, you know, someone from a particular church, a bishop, a temple, whatever it might be, comes out with a book and, wow. It is,
it's a major college. It's not a religious school. See, that's the thing that people sort of don't know, and I didn't know. When I was looking to find out, you know, I didn't really know much about the Bible, so I'm trying to find a reliable resource, and it turns out that 100% of historians and 100% of biblical scholars all agree. The only people that don't are fundamental Bible colleges and schools.
Well,
they're separate educational facilities, and I wasn't aware of that. I didn't realize that there were colleges that teach people that the world is 6,000 years old by the tens of thousands, but they're not accredited colleges.
Yeah, I hear your take on this. Another person who has done similar books, really thoughtful, amazing books, has been a frequent guest on the show. About the Bible would be Bishop John Shelby Spong, S-P-O-N-G. And John, I recommend that to you. He's amazing. Thank you so much for calling, John.
Sure. On that topic, you don't want to tell people that the world's not 6,000 years old. It's a
right.
It's
no,
a
I got your take on it.
Up.
Okay, thank you. All right. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we have more books to talk about. We're also going to talk with the editor of Drivel, Deliciously Bad Writing by Your Favorite Authors. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also to our producers, Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack, to Marion Roy, to Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut. And to those of you who've called in or tried, we really appreciate it. Coming up, we have the editor of Drivel, which is about a celebration of bad writing. And this is from authors themselves who've been brave enough to give it to the editor, and that's Julia Scott. So we're going to get to that in just a second. Couple of tweets at Yikes Sue. She says, FYI, American Sniper is also a movie starring Bradley Cooper. Thank you so much, Sue. And at A. Ardezoya, we have, my current read is How to Be a Victorian by Ruth Goodman. Fascinating firsthand look at everyday life in 19th century Britain. So that is How to Be a Victorian by Ruth Goodman. Roxanne, very quickly, what do you have?
I have a book called Preparing Children for Reading Success by Julie Irwin. And Julie is with Haskins Labs in Southern here in Connecticut. And she's written this book. You know, there's a real problem that we've got where kids are not hearing enough words, or parents don't know what books to read to them, or they don't know how to go about it, or how do you do it? How does it make a difference? And Julie has put together a really first-rate, practical book that's great for the mom that doesn't realize the importance, and great for the mom who does, and certainly an incredible resource for teachers.
Terrific.
So it's called Preparing Children for Reading Success. A very important book.
Okay, excellent. And so now we're going to talk to as Julia Scott, who's edited this book, Drivel.
Whoops.
Whoa. So the lamp is protesting. This is a book edited by Julia Scott, Drivel, Deliciously Bad Writing by Your Favorite Authors. Julia, welcome to the book show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, in this book we have contributions from Dave Eggers, Amy Tan, Chuck. Am I saying this right? Is it Poloniuk?
It's Palahniuk.
Palahniuk. Thank you so much. I've wondered this forever. Rick Moody, Mary Roach, Gillian Flynn, A.J. Jacobs, and more. How'd you collect these?
Lots of extortion and knee breaking was involved. No, just kidding. you know, it's interesting. Some authors really got into the concept of a book that, as you said, sort of celebrates the stage before a person can give birth to their best work, and thought that it was hilarious that it would be presented as a humor book where the authors were in on the joke. And some authors I approached just got it right away and dove enthusiastically into their mounds and mounds of terrible early writing. In many cases, they had their mothers go and search through trunks and attics to find these precious gems from their childhood.
You know what's amazing? You know what's amazing, Julia, is that I feel such shame about different things that I have written in the past, you know, that are just, let's just call it not my best work, that I cannot even bear to open, you know, a diary and look at it. I'm just so mortified. And so I just think these people are so brave and terrific.
I feel the same way. It was so fun working with these folks, you know, and it's funny too, you know, you have these, you know, really, I mean, all of the authors are authors of note in this book, but many of them are best-selling authors, and you threw out some of the names, Dave Eggers, Amy Tan, Gillian Flynn,
yeah.
Gone Girl, now,
so,
you know, motion picture.
Yeah, so,
and they, you know, they, I think you'd think at a certain point they would sort of decide that they have too much to lose. By bringing their putrid, turgid writing gems out for the world to see. But actually, all of those people have taught writing at one time or another in some capacity. And they appreciate the value of inspiration.
Yeah, well, let's do a couple. I'm going to quote from some of these. This is Neil Pollack. He's author of 8 books of fiction and nonfiction. He did that Alternadad book, which was a bestseller on parenting. That it's a memoir. And so he's outing himself for a job application that he wrote in 1992. And this is what it sounds like. He kept this. This was to Tina Brown, okay, who was the editor of The New Yorker at the time. And he writes,
right.
And he says, "Dear Ms. Brown, I'll cut to the quick. I would like to work for The New Yorker. And I imagine with the big changeover, you may need lots of editorial help. So I'm throwing my hat into the ring and asking you to consider hiring me as an editorial assistant for your new project. I've been precociously reading The New Yorker for some time now, and I am a devotee of the current magazine as well as of its historical heritage. Most of the writers I respect most, living and dead, have written for your magazine at some time. I'm willing to cut my journalistic and literary teeth elsewhere if I can't get a job at The New Yorker, but I'm determined not to end up anywhere else. The resume I've enclosed doesn't indicate this, but I've been working as a freelance writer since graduating. 2 months ago, I've been doing pretty well, but I'm still waiting for the big score. Maybe you could help. I strongly encourage you to take a chance on me, but if I don't suit your needs at this time, thank you for reviewing my application. I look forward to hearing from you."
Yeah, I love that. And I love the second letter in that selection where he's written to the editor of a magazine that doesn't exist anymore, saying, "I'm young and gutsy as a Marine in combat."
Right. That was Strobe Talbot, right? I think it was.
Yeah.
So here's one that you included in the book from Simon Rich, who's written for The New Yorker, and his books have been published in a dozen languages. And he dug up his, what were these from? Was this from his childhood, right? Did his mother write these down for him? Did he publish his own?
Simon is a former writer for SNL, and he's a humorist for The New Yorker now. And his contribution is one of the youngest, the hero is one of the youngest people. I think he was maybe 6 or 7 or something, very precocious when he wrote this family newspaper. He called it Simon's Newspaper. And he writes this very dry introduction about how the newspaper went under only after a couple of issues, but they gave it a good run. Basically, it was just an internal news letter that he typed up and shared with his older brother Nathaniel Rich, who's also in this book, and his father Frank Rich, who's writes for the, you know, obviously he's the columnist for the New York Times, and talking about current events as if they were news, except that the current events are things happening in their household.
So here's one. It starts with and he's dictating these. I think it wasn't his mother writing them down. I think, but he's dictating. He says, "Note: I have a brother Nathaniel. He's 4 years older than me. I was very much on the Nathaniel beat." Topic, bubblegum. Nathaniel Rich blew a bubble that was almost as big as my face. I thought it was pretty good. It was the biggest bubble I ever saw. It was almost as big as the S on Superman's chest. I mean, bigger. So that's all for the top story today. Then a topic, rock and roll. Nathaniel likes rock and roll. He even watches MTV. He loves rock and roll so much that he even talks about it. In fact, he doesn't like it. He loves it. He likes it even more than baseball cards. That's it.
That's it.
Then advertisements. Here is a list of what you could get your child for Christmas. 1, G.I. Joe figures. 2, Police Academy. 3, Double Dare. 4, Ring Raiders. 5, some clothes. And then he reviews a few things. And his editorial is, I mean, he did editorials. Mikhail Gorbachev, he writes about, he says, "Mikhail Gorbachev is a pretty good leader of France. He makes peace in the entire world." It's just absolutely adorable.
It is pretty cute. And what's fun about this book is that, you know, you have pieces that were written by children who are barely old enough to type their own words. And then you have pieces that, you know, 35-year-olds wrote and had the guts to give to us at a point in their lives when they seriously ought to have known better and were actually trying really too hard to write well.
Well, those are the really brave people in here. For instance, Poe Brownson says, you know, I think this was his attempt at a second novel. Here's just a sentence. "Leaves parachuting from delicate limbs, breathing and stretching and swaying in autumn rhythms, dancing as they fall this fall, in tune to winds and the gentle breezes from the top of the mountain."
And there is no grammar in that sentence, by the way. That is all one run-on.
Yeah, I don't think there's no verb in there. I don't think. So Elizabeth Bernstein, who lives in San Francisco, and she founded and edited the Big Ugly Review, which is a literary magazine online. It's done a lot of short stories and reviewed tons of things. So she has written Birth of a Flower. It is just amazing, and also illustrated it herself, which is really just awful. Birth of a Flower, Awakening of Spring, Awakening of a Flower, Birth of a Sun, Melting of Water, Dripping of Ice, Thawing of Green, Freezing of Blue, Parting of Clouds, Stirring of Wind, Blowing of Air, Cooling of Skin, Breathing of Risk, Temptation Dawns, Eyes Awaken, Perceive the Wind, Aware of the Flower, Feel the Green, Taste the Blue, Lick the Earth, Kiss the Sun, Birth of a Flower, Awakening of Spring, Taste of Life, End of Dream, Thawing of Winter, Birth of a Soul, Birth of a Flower, Awakening of Spring. Oh boy.
That's pretty great. One of the fun things about this book is that we were able to use the original college notebook page that Elizabeth scribbled that poem on, and she drew this picture of herself pregnant with possibilities. It has to be seen to be believed. And we have a lot of other original kind of notes and photos and self-submitted authors, you know, self-portraits from the time where they wrote their melodramatic, incomprehensible stuff.
Exactly. But, you know, there's also quite a number of people went back to childhood, which seems a little bit like cheating, but it's so fun. Here's Katie Crouch, the New York Times bestseller, author of Girls and Trucks, who goes back to her childhood and starts to quote herself from her diary. This was written in November of 1983. It's called Warm and Breezy. This is a very confusing time of life for me. Whoever is reading this, I will try to sort things out for you. To begin with, boys. A couple of boys show interest in me, but no one is fighting for me. There is this girl in my class called Frances Lumpkin, and everybody I know likes her. She's really pretty, careless, and fun to be with. Her mom owns a store called The Dandelion, and it's the most fashionable store in Charleston. She has the best clothes but couldn't care less, and she has kissed a lot of boys. I've only kissed one, and he was related to me. March 16th, she writes, sunny and warm. I am so happy. I have figured out a way to be popular. The girls are liking me a lot more than they used to. This is my way. Don't ever say something mushy. Never say yes and act careless. She's very interested in this careless idea.
It's a great word.
Yeah.
Careless. Act careless.
Yeah. Now, help me again. It's Chuck.
Polonic.
Chuck Polonic. This is amazing. Wouldn't you say, this is the most fascinating thing in here for
it's
me.
It's one of the highlights of the whole book. I don't know if you want to set it up or you want me to describe it.
Why don't you?
Chuck is, I mean, he's a genius humor writer, but this is a completely serious, earnest letter that he wrote to the dictator Pol Pot. When he was, I think, like 10 or 11 or 12.
And didn't he used to write to quite a number of dictators?
Right. He was trying to get them to undo their dictatory ways. But instead of writing as a young boy and trying to embarrass this dictator into stopping being a dictator, he wrote as a kind of in the guise of a narcissistic American movie producer, trying to get him to. Anyway, you can kind of take it from there. But it's a very sly, very funny letter to Pol Pot.
And, you know, now we're almost running out of time, Julia Scott. So I can't, by the way, author of Drivel. But, you know, this is dead serious, but also so clever when he takes this pose writing to Pol Pot that I can't even imagine what Pol Pot did.
How old was when he wrote that?
Was he 10 or? Yes, he was
11 years old.
Yeah, unbelievable. Thank you so much. Drivel, Deliciously Bad Writing by your favorite authors, edited by Julia Scott, our guest. Thank you, Roxanne Cody. This show, as always, is about the richness of life, and you can find the books we talk about and all kinds of new food posted at foodschmooze.org or WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.